From Vermont Public, this is The Frequency. I'm Anna Van Dyne.
And I'm Lexi Krupp. It's Wednesday, March 22nd. Here are today's headlines.
Governor Phil Scott, housing developers, and advocates for municipalities are urging lawmakers to reverse course on recent changes to a massive housing bill. The bill makes sweeping reforms to local and municipal zoning rules. Lawmakers also considered significant changes to Act 250, the state's land use law. But the Senate Committee on Natural Resources rolled back those changes. Ted Brady is executive director of the Vermont League of Cities and Towns. At a press conference Tuesday, Brady said if lawmakers want to curtail local control, they need to change Act 250.
In any other circumstance, we would be dead set against these preemptions. But our members have told us housing is their number one concern, so we're not walking away from the table. We're trying to find a compromise that works for Vermonters. That compromise needs to include more meaningful Act 250 changes.
The housing bill was referred to the Senate Appropriations Committee last week, which has a hearing on the legislation scheduled for Thursday.
A recent report from the Centers for Disease Control says a new tick-borne illness is on the rise in Vermont, and climate change is likely a factor. Babesiosis is spread by black-legged ticks, the same ones that spread Lyme disease. It's treatable, but can cause flu-like symptoms. Natalie Quitt is Vermont's public health veterinarian. She says while the Green Mountain State saw the biggest increase in cases of any state in the country, numbers here are still low relative to other states.
But we're talking about a change of 2 cases in 2011 to 34 cases in 2019.
As peak tick season approaches, experts say Vermonters can protect themselves from all tick-borne illnesses by wearing long sleeves and pants and using bug spray. Showering within 2 hours of coming in from going outdoors has also been shown to reduce risk.
And finally, a remembrance. Mad River Glen is the only cooperatively owned, not-for-profit ski area in the United States, and that's largely thanks to a woman named Betsy Pratt, who died last week at the age of 95. In 1972, Betsy and her husband Truxton led a group that bought the ski area from its founder. Betsy ran the mountain for 2 decades, preserving it from corporatization and consolidation. Then, in 1995, she sold it to the only people she could trust, the skiers themselves.
She conceptualized the co-op and created this vehicle to sell the mountain to the skiers, which was just an incredibly visionary thing.
Eric Friedman is executive director of the Mad River Valley Chamber of Commerce and previously worked at Mad River Glen. He says Betsy was cantankerous and direct, astute and innovative. She was a beautiful skier and would pass under Mad River's signature single chair in a blue snowsuit and pink boots. Off the slopes, she smoked a corncob pipe and dressed like she'd stepped straight out of an L.L. Bean catalog. Eric says Betsy believed that sport was more important than money, and even more important than that was a sense of community.
As soon as you walk into the ski area, if you've never been there before, it just feels different. And you don't necessarily know what it is, but you can feel it in your bones.
Betsy Pratt died on Friday, March 17th. According to an announcement from Mad River Glen, she spent her final days surrounded by family, watching a live stream of the single chair webcam as skiers went up and down the mountain she loved.
Coming up, the plan to clean up long abandoned copper mines in Orange County. That story after this.
Thanks for tuning in to The Frequency, and thanks to Vita for their support. Vita, celebrating 50 years of helping Vermont businesses grow and thrive. From agriculture to energy, startups to established companies, find solutions that fit your business. Visit veda.org to start your next chapter.
There's a set of abandoned copper mines in Orange County. These mines are designated as Superfund sites, among the most toxic waste sites in the country. The mining waste has been here for over a century, and last month, the federal government announced new funding to clean it up. But some neighbors have asked why it needs to be disturbed after all this time. I visited the remains of one of the mines in Corinth, along with our colleague Abigail Giles. The stream running down a large forested hillside in Corinth is clear, but the air smells of sulfur, and the water here is more acidic than lemon juice.
Up here, the pH of that water is about 2. And at that pH, all the metals are dissolved. And so you can get what looks like a nice clean stream, but because of the pH, it can be absolutely loaded in metals.
Ed Hathaway is a project manager at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. He's been working to clean up old mining sites around New England for more than 30 years. He says the water here isn't dangerous for people to be around, but it's deadly for most animals, for over a mile downstream.
For your normal trout, mayfly, a big drop in pH, 100% mortality. High concentrations of copper and zinc, you're going to see 100% mortality.
The water is so acidic and full of heavy metals because of the Pikehill copper mines. They first opened here in the 1800s. For decades, workers removed millions of pounds of copper from the earth. The mines wrap around the top of a small mountain. In some places, the miners dug pits straight into the earth. In others, they blasted horizontal tunnels and hauled the copper-rich rock out with carts and horses.
So they take the rock, they crush it, and often they would use both magnetic separation and froth flotation, meaning they would just put it in a bath and they would use like a pine oil or something. And the divalent metals, copper is a divalent metal, would stick to that froth that's skimming off, concentrate it, and ship it.
That process left huge piles of dirt and rocks behind. They're still here from when the mine shut down in the early 1900s. When rain or groundwater hits those piles, it reacts with the sulfide inside the dirt and rocks and forms sulfuric acid. That acid runoff and the heavy metals it picks up along the way are what make the stream so toxic.
Because of that runoff, in the early 2000s, the mine was declared a Superfund site. That's a federal program to clean up some of the most polluted areas in the country. But even with this label, for more than a decade, nothing at Pikehill changed. The site was something of a local attraction.
Whenever people came from out of town, we would go up to the mine just because it was an oddball destination.
Virginia Barlow has lived in Corinth most of her life, working as a forester and writer.
I was always just taken aback to see how barren the landscape was without any vegetation. The soil was still is a strange orangey color. And the brook, I remember, that leaves the mine was just creepy looking.
Her house isn't far from the mine, and the woods behind it are marked with evidence of the quest for copper that once dominated life here.
On our land and our neighbor's land, there are big trenches and pits where people obviously were digging looking for copper, but didn't find it.
Last year, the EPA announced it had a plan to clean up the Pikehill mine. A colony of endangered bats lives in the shafts, so the cleanup has to be done carefully. And the EPA isn't going to seal up the mine tunnels. Instead, they're going to gather all the dirt that's leaching acid into one or two big piles and cover it with plastic.
We need to get it out of contact with water, and then we cap it, and that cap prevents that oxygen diffusion into the waste. So when you remove the water and you limit the oxygen, then you shut that reaction off.
This idea has worked before at the much bigger Elizabeth mine, about 25 miles away. Another long dormant copper mine site, the Ely mine in Verscher, is also slated for cleanup.
A lot of these projects are starting now because Congress set aside a lot more money for this kind of work. Vermont got $38 million through the bipartisan infrastructure law that passed in 2021. And more money for the Pikehill mine was set aside earlier this year.
The bipartisan infrastructure law injection of a lot more funding is sort of putting now on a fast track some projects that have been languishing, because there wasn't either the federal funding or the private funding to make it happen.
David Cash leads the EPA's work in New England. He says federal lawmakers also brought back something called the polluters pay tax, which will create a big pot of money for future Superfund cleanups.
Not everyone in Corinth is happy about the cleanup plan, though. The project is expected to cost almost $20 million, and thousands of truckloads of materials are expected to pass through town. Virginia Barlow gets the concern.
I think the current plan is a little overwhelming to people. It's a huge expense of resources and time and money, moving a massive amount of earth, both on the site and from away. And people, of course, are worried about the roads.
People like Olivia Harding Tillman. She and her husband own a winery on the same quiet dirt road that will see all the truck traffic.
There's no lights up here. There's really no cars that go by. So the disruptions to the people that are here seems extreme for the amount of mitigation that they're actually doing.
Olivia says things would be different if the mine were poisoning people's well water. But it's not. That's a complaint Ed from the EPA has heard a lot. But he says the Superfund program is not just about cleaning up public health hazards. It's also meant to address threats to the environment, like a section of river without any life in it, surrounded by toxic soils.
Part of the sell is, well, if it was so important, why didn't you ever deal with it? It's been here so long. It didn't just happen, you know, but I think it just had to wait its turn.
The work at Pike Hill won't start until next year, at the earliest. Then it'll take several years to complete.
And tomorrow we'll have the second part of this story on the largely forgotten history of the copper mining industry in the state.
Thanks for listening to The Frequency today. We had additional reporting from Liam Elder Connors.
Our executive producer is Mark Davis, and our music is by Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Lexi Krupp.
And I'm Anna Van Dyne. Talk to you tomorrow.
How are we supposed to fix what we don't talk about? Welcome to Homegoings, a Vermont Public podcast that encourages fearless conversations about art and race.
It's like an extended family, and especially around homegoing time.
Join us for Homegoings, wherever you get your podcasts. We're a proud member of the NPR network.